In chapter 2, we have 5 sections. Since Murijan Prabhu was the one who started doing this something, I don't know, about 15 years ago, and practically every year he would change the title a little bit, you know. It was basically the same, but they were changing. I remember they changed maybe 4 or 5 times while I was teaching. And then I had my own, you know, preferences. So, anyway, you don't have to get too mental about the section titles, but at least you should know what is the topic of that section. What, you know, whatever you call it. In his book, Saranantami Arjuna Burijan has written 1 to 10, More Doubts. And in the VTE manual, it's given Arjuna's further doubts and surrender. And then 11 to 13, he called Jnana. And they added in the VTE manual, fight, there is no death for the soul. Because it's describing Samkhya Yoga. So it's called Jnana. And the purpose is fight. Why? Because there's no death for the soul. Then from 31 to 38, he called it in his book Karma Kanda. And in the manual, they added fight. By performing prescribed duties, gain material enjoyment. Yeah. Then from 39 to 53, Buddhi Yoga, in parentheses, Nishkam Karma. And in the manual, Buddhi Yoga, fight, but without any reaction. So they're adding some additional things here. And then the last section, 54 to 72, in his book he called it Samadhi. In his book, I think the general approach was to try to make very short titles so that devotees can remember them. And in the manual, they added some things to clarify what does it mean, Samadhi. But in this manual, it's called Stitta Pragya, fight, become fixed in Krishna consciousness. Okay. All right. But in any case, all of the sections are the same length, and they have the same basic title, the same meaning. So we're in the middle of the second section, which is called Jnana, or Sankhya Yoga, or whatever you want to call it. And the last verse we did was 23, where Krishna was describing that Arjuna, you cannot kill the soul with any of the weapons you have in your chariot, with your arrows, your sword, or with your wind, water weapons. The soul cannot be destroyed by any of these things. And now in verse 24, some of the same points are made by Krishna. Let us chant the verse. Achedyo yam madhayo yam akledyo shosha evacha nitya sarva kata stanur achalo yam sanatanaha. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble, and can never be and can be neither burned nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. So some repetition is there to remove doubts of those who are still uncertain, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says. And so, achedya, unbreakable, the soul is not cleavable, as the Mayavadis think that Brahman is one, you know, homogeneous mass and then it is broken into pieces when it's placed under illusion. And then when all of those illusioned parts attain liberation, then they kind of move back into their original homogeneous one form. And that the individuality is only temporary. But here Krishna says achedya, that the soul is actually indivisible. So that includes Brahman too. And adhayo, it's not able to be burnt. That was also described. Akledyo, insoluble, not with water. Ashosha, it cannot be dried by the wind weapons. Nitya sarvakator stanur, that is eternally more present everywhere, everlasting. And stanur means unchangeable. Again, it's repeated for clarity, because in the previous verse it's also mentioned. Stanur means the stability of the soul. Or not in the previous verse, but maybe some other previous verse. Achalo. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, here it's repeated achalo, which basically means the same thing. That it's unchangeable or immovable. Stanur, according to Baladeva Vidyabhushan, he says that means that the jiva sarup is unchangeable. It's permanent. And he says that achala means that his qualities are fixed. Because sometimes devotees say, what does it mean when Krishna says that the soul is unchangeable? And I always used to answer that. I think it means that his sarup doesn't change. And then I later read that Baladev's comment, and so it was confirmed. Prabhupada quotes that, Prabhupada writes in his commentary, the theory of monism is very difficult to apply in this case because the individual soul is never expected to become one homogeneously. Souls don't merge into one mass soul. They remain separate. The word sarvakata, all-pervading, is significant because there is no doubt that living entities are all over God's creation. They live on the land, in the water, in the air, within the earth, and even within fire. Huh? What about him? It means that the characteristics of the soul do not change. They're permanent. The qualities. So sarvagata means that the living entity is everywhere. And Prabhupada says that living everywhere, if the sun globe is uninhabited, then the word sarvagata becomes meaningless. So the souls can live on the sun planet. That's no problem. They have fire bodies. Here, our bodies are made of water, mostly. Maybe 98% or whatever. 95% water and a little earth mixed in. So the earth planet is mostly water with some earth. So it appears that the bodies are constructed according to the planet, or at least similar to the planet that they're residing on. Text 25. Avyakto yam machintyo yam avikaryo yam uchyate tasmad evam viditvainam nanu shokchitam arhasi. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. By the way, I think you'll notice that in many of these verses, you'll see this nanu shochitam arhasi, or nanum shochitam, whatever, in many places. And in the beginning of this section, Krishna said also the same thing. Right? Ashochan. Anvashochastvam. So the word shocha or shoch or shuch, I believe the verbal root is shuch, which means to lament. And it becomes gunated and shoch, shochiti, sa shochiti. He's lamenting. Then we see at the end that Krishna says, don't lament. Right? Saradharmam prityaja mamekam sharanam vaja aham tam sarapapajyo mokshay shami ma shucha. So this is a very major or important word and a major theme in the Bhagavad Gita. For somebody who becomes Krishna conscious, self-realized, then he doesn't lament. And a lot of it is based on this Sankhya or Atma Tattva, which is what that we're studying now. If someone doesn't is not fixed in the realization of Atma Tattva, then he can't attain that Ma Shuchaha, this instruction by Krishna at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, which is the essence of the key verse to enter into bhakti. Moksha ishyami mashucha. I deliver them. Or I will deliver you. He's speaking to Arjuna, but he's also speaking to us. So, avyakto means that he's very subtle, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti. And avikarya means he doesn't go through the six kinds of transformations, which are material transformations. Birth, growth, maintenance, reproduction, dwindling, and death. And achintya means that he pervades the whole body as consciousness, which is inconceivable. Because the soul is so small that you can't see it, but yet its consciousness has expanded from the very top of your head to the soles of your feet. And if somebody taps you on the head or sticks a needle in your foot, you know, it's like you're very much aware of all parts of your body, isn't it? Yet the soul is just in the heart. And it's like a very, very, very small micro atom. So that is kind of mystical, how the consciousness pervades the body. Prabhupada writes that there are many things we have to accept solely on grounds of superior authority. Right? Because you can't see the soul, you can't smell it, you can't touch it. No one can deny the existence of his father based on the authority of his mother. There is no source of understanding the identity of the father except by the authority of the mother. Similarly, there is no source of understanding the soul except by studying the Vedas. In another place, Krishna tells Arjuna that as one can see form only with the eyes, Arjuna, similarly, one can understand dharma only through the Vedas. So don't manufacture your own system of dharma. Where is it? I don't know, I can't remember. We'll get to that. That's not in this commentary. I'm saying in another place in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna this. As one sees, I've mentioned in Gita Amrita, As one sees form only with the eyes, Arjuna, similarly, you can understand Dharma only through the Vedas. So you become Shastra Chakshu. So now, in the next verse, Krishna's thinking, and he says, he's thinking to himself, he thinks, I have thus far explained things from the viewpoint of Shastra. So now, I'll explain them to Arjuna from the practical point of view. And this is also Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Because he says atacha. When it's atacha, it means that the angle is changing. Which means then again. Or however, like this. It means he's changing his pitch or his angle. Krishna is changing his approach to the same topic, but from a different view, different angle, different viewpoint. Atacha. Then again, or if, however, you think that the soul is always born and dies forever, you still have no reason to lament, O mighty R. We'll chant it also. Atachainam nitya jatam nityam vamanyase mritam. Tathapi tvam mahabaho nainam shochitum arhasi. So, it's also interesting that, in other words, Prabhupada explains that during the time of the Vedic age, when Krishna was around, there are the Vaibhashika and Lokayatika. Persons who are basically like Buddhists or atheists, or like similar to the modern day scientists who don't believe in the soul. So Krishna wants to cover all the different arguments that Arjuna may come up with in his mind. So it's kind of like checkmate. Now he says that, okay, if you don't accept the soul, oh, great armed one. it's like mocking, sarcastically calling him Mahabaho. Oh, great armed one, oh, great Vedic hero. If you don't accept that there is a soul, I mean, come on, Arjuna, even the rickshawwalas accept that there's a soul. that's the idea. And if you think that the soul continually takes birth and then dies forever, then still you have no reason to lament, because it means that the body is just chemicals, and it's just there's no problem in transforming the chemicals. You just kill the person, and all of the body, the materials of the body, just go back into the earth. That's where they came from. So then, if you don't believe in the soul, then still there's no reason to get upset about killing your relatives. So in this way, he checkmates our dear friend Sakha Arjun. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes from the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 54, text 40. Kshatriyanam ayam dharma prajapati vinilmitaha bharatapi brataram hanyat yena ghoratamas tataha. He says that the dharma of the kshatriya is given by prajapati, and bratapi, brataram, hanyat. It includes killing one's brother. Sometimes kshatriyas have to kill their brother. Therefore, yena ghoratamas tata. Therefore, this kshatriya dharma is horrible. Or, ghastly. So the English translation, always born, means that if you think that the act of birth is perpetual, which means continual, constantly going on, and that the soul dies forever, means that he dies repeatedly, then still you have no reason to lament. If you think that the soul is always born, means that the soul repeatedly takes birth again and again, that it's perpetual, it means ongoing or eternal, eternally taking birth, or that it dies repeatedly.
Well, it's like Mr. Jain said, the Kshatriya Dharma is like dormant, it's like horrible.
Horrible.
So how is it that this scripture is describing something horrible?
Well, it's, you may say it's horrible to kill animals. The Brahmanas, they have to kill the horse and the goat and different yagyas also. I believe if you look at this, we have to see the context also. It's the 54th chapter of Krishna Lila in the 10th canto. So I didn't actually look at it, but I believe the context is that sometimes a kshatriya may have to do that. And we see that Parashuram killed his mother. Right? That's also horrible. But his father ordered that, so he had to follow that order. And then later he got the boon and then brought his father and his brothers back to life, without their having any memory of them being killed. So, yeah, it's, the Vedas are giving instructions, you know, not just to please our senses, but to elevate us, to come closer to God. And sometimes it may be very uncomfortable, the things that the person may have to do to follow his dharma. But it's all thought out well in advance by the Supreme Lord. So if the kshatriya, you know, if someone's brother becomes evil or attacks the kingdom, you know, so then if the person is a kshatriya in that kingdom, then it's his duty to fight and kill his own brother. Then he has to do that, because it's based on the principle of righteousness and religion. Bharat had to reject his own son from being the next king because he was unqualified. So that must have been also very painful for him. And Dasarath promised his wife that he would follow whatever she said. And when she said, you know, exile Ram to the forest, it was very painful for him to do that. But he had to do that. Why? Because he gave his word. So when a man gives his word, then he has to follow that. So, you know, there, in Dharma, there may be many things which are painful and ghastly, may be considered kind of horrible according to the mind, the material mind of the person. But if a brother becomes evil and he's attacking the kingdom, then it's your duty to fight him. Of course, he may try to just, you know, capture him alive. You know, just like Ashwatthama, he had killed the sleeping sons of Draupadi. And then when captured, Bhima said, "Let's kill him." And Draupadi said, "No, we can't kill him." And then Arjuna was confused, "What am I going to do?" Then he looked at Krishna. Krishna said, "You know, hey, come on, use your intelligence. Just think about it for a while." Then he said, "Okay." He cut off his gem in his head, like this. Jayadratha did the same thing. He kidnapped Draupadi, and then, you know, was Dhaumya saw this. And then he reported to the Pandavas, And the Pandavas started chasing Jayadratha and caught him, and Bhima just beat the hell out of him. He was practically dead, you know. And then they cut off all of his hair except for 5 hairs. And made him announce to all the Kshatriyas that, "I am a servant of Yudhisthira." And then they just send him out, kicked him out of the camp. You know, so some things may be a little difficult and horrible, you know. If the person may not have to kill his brother, but he may have to. Like if all of the Pandavas and Krishna told Arjuna, he must be killed, then Krishna would have killed. Ashwatthama was the son of the Brahman. But he thought of a different way to kill him. Arjuna had made the vow that anyone who tells that I will put down the Gandiva bow, that I will kill him. And then during the battle, you know, he heard that Yudhisthira was wounded by Karna, that he was almost dead. So he immediately went back to the encampment and went into the royal tent to Yudhisthira by his bedside to see if he was still alive or whatever. And Yudhisthira said, "Oh, Arjuna, you heard what happened?" "Yes, yes, I heard that you were fighting with Karna. He said, "Yes. So did you kill him?" And he said, "No, I just rushed here to see how you were." And he said, "What? You didn't kill him? He attacked me and you still left the battlefield without killing Karna?" He said, "What kind of Kshatriya are you? You should just give your Gandiva bow to some real man, real Kshatriya." And then Arjuna was like, you know, overcome, because, "How can you say that?" And then he remembered, "I made a vow that if anyone tells that I should give my Gandiva bow, I will kill him." So he took out his sword. And Krishna said, "Hey, what are you doing, Baba? You know, you crazy?" He said, "Listen, Arjuna." He grabbed his arm. He said, "Listen, you can't kill your brother. He's a king. And he's unarmed and he's ill. He's been wounded. What about that dharma?" He said, "Yes, but I made my vow. I made my promise." He said, "But there's many other kinds of dharma also. You can't just kill an unarmed man. And besides, he's the king. And he's your brother. And not only is your brother, he's your elder brother, who you should worship like God. What about those dharmas, Arjuna?" Then Arjuna was bewildered. "So what should I do?" He said, "Well," he said, "if you insult the Kshatriya, it is worse than killing him." So then Arjuna, "Okay." So then he came to Yudhisthira and he said, "Look what you've done. Just because you're attached to gambling, you started this whole damn war. And now you're laying here and you're not doing anything on the battlefield." And he started, you know, criticizing it in different ways, you know. "All because of your attachment for gambling. And I told you at that time I would have killed them all. But you said, 'No, we must follow dharma.'" And then Yudhisthira, and then he fell at Yudhisthira's feet. And he grabbed his feet and he started crying. "So please forgive me for insulting you." And he says, "Okay." And Krishna was, "All right." Haribol. So, you know, dharma is not so easy to understand. But sometimes the brother may have to be killed. Of course, the Kshatriya will always try to avoid that. But in some circumstances, like Parashuram, he had to kill his brothers and even his mother because of the order of the father. It was horrible. But luckily, he got the boon that not only they would forget it, but he would forget it also. So that, because otherwise, you know, probably would have had some psychological problems. He would need some counseling, you know, after that. Okay, let's go on. So Krishna's changing his view, atacha, and Prabhupada also mentions Krishna sarcastically addressed Arjuna's Mahabahu, because he at least did not accept the theory of the Vaibhashika, which leaves aside Vedic wisdom. Okay, 27. Jatasihi dhruvo mrityu dhruvam janma mrityasya cha tasmada pariharyate natvam shochitam arasi. One who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. So when someone's prarabdha karma is exhausted, then his death is certain. That is the meaning here by Vishwanath Chakravarti. Prabhupada says in the commentary, this cycle of birth and death does not, however, support unnecessary murder, slaughter, and war, like in Iraq. No, I'm adding that. But at the same time, violence and war are inevitable factors in human society for keeping law and order. The Battle of Kurukshetra, being the will of the Supreme, was an inevitable event, and to fight for the right cause is the duty of a Kshatriya. Why should he be afraid or aggrieved at the death of his relatives, since he was discharging his proper duty? He did not deserve to break the law, thereby becoming subjected to the reactions of sinful acts, of which he was so afraid. By avoiding the discharge of his proper duty, he would not be able to stop the death of his relatives, and he would be degraded due to his selection of the wrong path of action. In the Gitamrita, I wrote that Krishna says, the soul separate from the body is eternal, Arjuna. The soul in contact with the body is birth, and the soul losing contact with the body is death. Both happen according to karma. This is all karma, Arjuna. You must understand this principle. No one can change this. This war is by the will of providence. So don't lament. They must die anyway, according to their karma. But you'll act irreligiously if you don't do the duty, but perform your duty of fighting. Text 28. Avyakta dini bhutani vyakta madhyani bharata avyakta nidhananyeva tatraka paridevana. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Prabhupada comments, accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in the existence of the soul, there is no cause for lamentation in either case, which is what the verse says. Non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. Yet if, for argument's sake, we accept this atheistic theory, there is still no cause for lamentation. And he describes the material elements and then says, take for example a big skyscraper manifested from the earth. When it is dismantled, the manifestation becomes again unmanifested and remains as atoms in the ultimate stage. The law of conservation of energy remains. But in course of time, things are manifested and unmanifested. That is the difference. Then what cause is there for lamentation, either in the stage of manifestation or in unmanifestation? In other words, a person is unmanifested before birth, and then his body grows and his life is manifested, or his, his world is manifest, his body is manifested. And then at some point he must die, so his body is unmanifested again. So what is the need for lamenting because the manifestation is, there's going through these stages, unmanifest, manifest, and unmanifest. It's just various transformations of matter. Like a skyscraper. It's just, you know, bricks or stones in the earth. Then some people come together and they build it. And at some point in history, it will crumble. So, one second. So Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur comments that having dispelled lamentation in regard to the Atma by the verse Jayate Mriyate Va Kadachin, and lamentation, and he's, and having dispelled also lamentation for the body by the verse Jatasihi Dhruvo Mrityu, Lord Krishna now dispels lamentation for both Atma and the body in this verse. So that should clarify this. You have a question?
You know, in this argument, this idea, I must follow this example very clearly. Because, you know, as you may be knowing, like Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord, he eats dirt, Lord Chaitanya. And then he says, same thing, it's only to me. You know, you give me food, is also conversion of power. You know, so he was
speaking
like Maya philosophy.
Right.
And this sounds somewhat similar, you know,
yeah.
The thing is constructed, it's unmanifest, so what is the difference? But you see that there is a difference, like, in case, like, you give a child a toy, you know, it's a wonderful toy.
A child's toy.
Yeah, if you give a child a toy, yeah. And, you know, he gets attracted to the form, you know, to the shape and everything.
Right.
So if you break it, and you may say that, you know, it's... He'll cry. Yeah. So he's attached to the form and everything, so... How come, like, you say that there's nothing to lament? It sounds like in
Mayavad. Well, first of all, Arjuna's not a child, right? So if the toy breaks, then he shouldn't cry.
Take, for example, a car. Purchase a new car. Right. Get a small dent on it. Four, yeah.
So then there's no reason to lament, right? It's like cars. A person understands that, well, if I drive the car around enough, then sooner or later it's going to get a few bumps and I may even smash it. But it's, you know, it's not that important. So even though this is... this is like a philosophy to cover both the person who believes in the soul and the person who doesn't, in this verse. Because if you just look at it, that the person's unmanifest, then he becomes manifest for some time, and then he's unmanifest again. So that's just the cycle of the way things go. You buy a car or a computer, and you know that it's not going to last forever. That after 5 or 10 years of a lot of use, you're going to have to buy a new one. And so when the computer breaks down, you know, or after 6 or 7 years, it's falling apart, and you know, the screen doesn't work, or some of the keys don't work, then, you know, you think, okay, it's had its day. It's finished. And we have, an ambassador. After 15, 20 years, then you know that you can't drive it forever. So then when it finally sees its last excursion, you know, the driver says, okay, Haribo. he's renounced. I think this is the general idea in presenting. That's why Prabhupada gives the example of the skyscraper. Yes.
I just want to clarify this understanding. What Buddhists, they believe in reincarnation, but not in karma?
Buddhists. Right. Quite strange, huh? They don't believe in the soul, huh? This is, yeah, it's mentioned, Prabhupada mentions nine factors, I think, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I remember reading that some years ago. I mean, I have to review it to see. Yeah, I was always thinking, how is it that they could believe in reincarnation, but they don't believe in the soul? And I just thought, well, maybe they think that, like, the person is the subtle body, some kind of thing which is more subtle than the gross body, but they don't accept that there's an eternality of the soul. And that subtle thing, whatever it may be, it merges into nirvana, just attains a non-existent state.
Each elements are merging in the, like, earth, water, fire.
I think they accept that. What they think of as a self is maybe a mystery to me. Can you? Huh?
To them also.
Yeah, it's not quite clear what they think is the self. I mean, like, if you ask a Christian also, you know, because they also say that the flesh is willing but the spirit is weak, and you ask them, what is the spirit? You know, like, what is the thing which is, if Jesus comes again and then revives everyone, then, you know, what is the thing that he's reviving? And they seem to think that the bodies come right out of the graves and then just become alive again. You know. So they don't have a clear understanding of what the self is. And it appears that the Buddhists don't either. Okay. 29. This is called the amazing verse. Ascharyavat pasyati kastaminam, ascharyavat variti tataiva chanya, ascharyavat chainamanya shrinopi, shudvapyenam veda nataiva kastin. Some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. So this whole material world is a combination of the body and the soul. He's completely detached. Right. So Vishwanath Chakravarti also says, speaking as Krishna, "Oh, Arjuna, if you ask what is this amazing subject that I'm speaking about, then please listen carefully. It is wisdom has not awakened." That is amazing. So he's kind of insulting, again giving a little slap to Arjuna. And Baladeva Dipushan mentions that the term Ascharyavat can be applied in three different ways. One, to the subject; two, to the object; and three, to the verb. When the Ascharyavat is applied to the verb, it becomes an adverb. In the English grammar, at least, you know what you call it in Hindi. Like, in other words, the sentence, "Some look on the soul as amazing." The soul is the object of the verse. So some see the soul as amazing. But you can say, some people who are amazing look on the soul. Because anyone who's looking on the soul is amazing. Right? So not only the soul, but the people who are looking are amazing. And you could also translate it as, some people amazingly look on the soul. Which means that the act of seeing is amazing. The soul is amazing. Because most people can't see it. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan says that the term Ascharyavat can be applied to the subject, the object or the verb in the sentence. So in each, there's three sentences in the verse. So you can translate it in three different ways. Just like, give you an example, the next sentence, some describe him as amazing. So you could say, some amazing people describe him. Or you can say, some people amazingly describe him. In this way, the word ischayavat can be applied to all of the parts of the grammar.
Huh? Three times three?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Nine versions of translation.
Three.
Oh, well, I mean, if you one sentence you translated, applied it to the subject, the next sentence you applied it to the object, and the next sentence you applied it to the verb, then you could switch them around. Three, three, and three different combinations. It's possible. Basically, there's three different translations. There's an interesting statement Prabhupada mentioned in the last paragraph. The easiest process for understanding the subject matter of self, however, is to accept the statements of the Bhagavad Gita spoken by the greatest authority, Lord Krishna, without being deviated by other theories. But it also requires a great deal of penance and sacrifice, either in this life or in the previous ones, before one is able to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna can, however, be known as such by the causeless mercy of the pure devotee and by no other way. That's an interesting point. So now Krishna summarizes this section in the next and last verse of this section. Dehi nityam avadyo yam dehi sarvasya bharata tasmat sarvani bhutani natvam shokchitum arhasi. O descendant of Bharat, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. So Arjuna says, what should I do now? Please instruct me specifically or definitively. And Krishna says, give up your lamentation and fight, Arjuna. That is the meaning of this verse. So along with concluding, he instructs Arjuna that you should now fight. Don't lament, start to fight. Prabhupada comments, the Lord now concludes the chapter of instruction on the immutable spirit soul. Therefore Arjuna as a Kshatriya should not abandon his duty out of fear that his grandfather and teacher Bhishma and Drona will die in the battle. Right, because the soul is immortal and the body is temporary. Then he says, though the soul is immortal, violence is not encouraged. Because some people may misuse this philosophy. Oh, the soul is immortal, so now I can kill anybody I want. Because Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that we should not lament. But Prabhupada says so, violence is not encouraged. But at the time of war, it is not discouraged when there is actual need for it. That need must be justified in terms of the sanction of the Lord and not capriciously. In other words, someone can't just decide that, yes, you know, war is necessary now and I'll kill you. Okay, so that's the end of that Sankhya or Jnana section, no death for the soul. And now, Krishna begins speaking about Arjuna's Swadharma, which is in Varnashram Dharma. Yes?
So, Prabhupada says, it requires a great deal of penance and austerity to know the soul.
Right.
In the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Vichashushrushaya Vacham, where he says, Idaptena Tapaskaya. Right. Those who do not perform austerity, they cannot understand this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. So, I just wanted
to clarify. You shouldn't try to preach to those kind of people. Shouldn't preach to those who, without people who are not austere.
Okay. So this knowledge cannot be understood. And right. Then we say this is a treatise for bhakti, and bhakti is the only qualification. So here, how do you understand the role of austerity?
Well, it means that if a person is just a gross sense enjoyer, then he won't be able to enter into bhakti. As we'll see, Bhogaishvarya Prasaptana. And in the Uddhava Gita, the same thing is mentioned. Yadrichaya matkatado jata shradasto yam puman nanirvino nati sakto bhakti yoga sasirida. So someone who is nanirvino, if he's not too disgusted, and nati sakto, if he's not too attached, nati sakto, then he's qualified for performing bhakti yoga. So someone, austerity therefore would mean that someone is able to control the senses and he's not a gross sense enjoyer. He's too attached to sense enjoyment, he can't begin the practice of bhakti. So it does require some penance and some austerity. Something has to mean that, at least in the matter of sense control. Not that he has to, you know, go to the Himalayas and live in a cave for 12 years and eat only, roots and, sit in the ring of fire and all that stuff. But there's some penance has to be there. Okay, so now Swadharma. So Krishna shifts gears a bit. He's wondering that if he would consider Swadharma, then also he should not be disturbed. He consider the whole situation according to his duty as a Kshatriya, not only according to the philosophy of Sankhya, but then also that should help him to remain fixed and perform his duty of fighting. Sadharmam apicha vikshya na vikampitum arasi dharmyadhi yudachreyonyat kshatriyasya na vidyate. Considering your specific duty as a kshatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles, and so there is no need for hesitation. So here we see the word dharma yudha. Shreyonya. Right? There's nothing better for a kshatriya than to get involved with dharma yudha. There's nothing better than that for a kshatriya. And Prabhupada's commentary is devoted to describing varnashram, and particularly the kshatriya, who kshat, gives protection. Kshat means to hurt, and trayate means to deliver or give protection from pain and attack. Mentions about the kshatriya, facing a tiger with a sword only, and that the kshatriya is still in Jaipur state, and that for kshatriyas, they never need to take sannyas. When kshatriyas, they only take vanaprastha, etc. And he quotes from the Dharma Shastras. This is probably the Manu Samhita. Then at the end of the commentary, he says that there are two kinds of swadharmas, or specific duties. As long as one is not liberated, one has to perform the duties of his particular body in accordance with religious principles in order to achieve liberation. When one is liberated, one's Swadharma, specific duty, becomes spiritual. So before liberation, there's the lower level, the Varnashram Dharma. And the higher Swadharma is Sanatana Dharma. When one's liberated, then his duty becomes spiritual. Two other statements in the commentary are worthy of noting, that human civilization begins from the stage of Varnashram Dharma. If someone is not performing Varnashram, then they're not humans, they're animals. Dvipad Pashu. As we see, even in India, most of the people walking around on the streets are Dvipad Pashu, because many of them are not following Varnashram principles. And what to speak of the Western countries. Wholesale, all of them are like that. And the last sentence, discharging one's specific duty in any field of action in accordance with the orders of higher authorities serves to elevate one to a higher status of life. Right? So performing your specific duty in any field of action in accordance with higher authorities, that brings to elevation. Even just following the horrible Kshatriya Dharma. Because it's given by higher authorities. So that means that there's some submissiveness, you know, and particularly some recognition of God given in the Veda. God has given the Veda and we'll follow this. Next verse. Yadrichaya chokpapanam svargadharam apavatam sukhina kshatriya parta labante yudamindrisham. O Partha, happy are the kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. So the second reason or objection that Arjuna gave was enjoyment. Right. He was very concerned about enjoying. Remember, he said, Ka priti syat Janardana. What pleasure will we get, Janardana? So, since you are the killer of all living beings, so you go and kill them, and I'll sit here on my chariot nicely. Right? He said, Kim bhogaya. What enjoyment will there be, Govinda? So that second reason is now, or that second objection is now being refuted directly by Krishna. And this is the second section. So Krishna is working in order of Arjuna's objections. Seems that Krishna either has a very good memory, or he's done this before many times. Or maybe both. Because in a conversation, sometimes you may get lost. What was the second reason again? You know, even when you're studying it, you may forget. But Krishna's pretty sharp. He's right on his case. So Krishna's saying, more happiness for those killed in a Dharma Yuddha. Right? The Kshatriyas get more happiness for those killed in a Dharma Yuddha. So, to give more happiness to Bhishma and the others, more happiness than to yourself, then you should kill them. You should kill him. To give Bhishma more happiness than you're getting. Why? Because Kshatriya gets more happiness when he's killed in the Dharma Yuddha. So if you're concerned about your happiness, then you'll get happiness when you win the war. And if you're concerned about Bhishma's happiness, then he'll be happy when he goes to heaven.
Translation: happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought.
That means that
opening for them the doors of the heavenly palace. Mm-hmm. So if someone sought fighting in place of Adharma, then they will not get the heavenly palace.
I don't know if that is. I don't think that is a prerequisite as for the definition. I think that Krishna is just here speaking that, you know, in general, the Kshatriyas out of duty, because the Dharma Yuddha just will appear. It's not that they try to create, you know, a religious war. Isn't it? That's the general idea. Dharma Yuddha just kind of happens, yadrchaya, by the will of providence.
War may occur because of encroaching something else. So one side will be encroaching, the other will be protecting it. So here, those who are protecting are on the path of Dharma. For them, the fight comes unsought. But for those who are encroaching, they are creating the fight. So here the distinction comes.
I don't think this is like a sentence of definition. I think it is a kind of, how do you say, not whimsical, but it just happens that he's saying like this. I can look a little bit more into that. Maybe I can mention this to him. We'll look into the commentaries. Okay. 33. Oh, let's see. What did we have here?
Question.
You have a question? Yes. Actually, I think it's better if we... Let's finish the section, and then we can have the questions afterwards. That'll be, I think, make everybody more happy. Because then we... finish one train of thought and we can consider it. Krishna says that since the Kshatriyas get more happiness when they're killed in a Dharma Yuddha, so therefore therefore you can make Bhishma happier than you yourself by killing him and the others as well. And in Gitamrita I said that since you want to benefit your relatives, then kill them and send them to heaven. It has come without effort, this war, accepted as the will of providence. Yadrchaya, you're fortunate to fight with such great heroes as Bhishma and Drona. And glory will come by fighting. Text 33. From text 33 to 36, Krishna is describing the defects of not fighting. Atta chetvam imam dharmyam sagramam na karishyasi tatta sa dharmam kirtim cha hitvam papam avapsyasi. So again we see atta cha. So that means he's saying, if you don't want to fight, right? If however you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. Right? Sadharmam hitva kirtam cha. You give up your dharma and you give up your fame also. And then what do you get? Papam avapsyasi. you'll get sin. Prabhupada mentions that Arjuna pleased Lord Shiva. He defeated him and pleased him and then attained the Pashupat Astra. And that Dronacharya also benedicted and awarded him with weapons by which he could kill even his teacher. So Dronacharya was quite renounced. Huh? He wasn't worried about dying. And he had attained many certificates from great authorities, even Indra. So, but if he abandoned his battle, this battle, and neglected his duties, then he would lose all of that fame. Akirtim chapi bhutani katayishyanti te bhayam sambhivattasya chakirti maranadati richyate. People will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. Here, Prabhupada makes a very wonderful comment. Arjuna, if you leave the battlefield before the battle even begins, people will call you a coward. And if you think that people may call you bad names, but that you will save your life by fleeing the battlefield, then my advice is that you do better to die in the battle. For a respectable man like you, ill fame is worse than death. So you should not flee for fear of your life. Better to die in battle. That will save you from the ill fame of misusing my friendship and from losing your prestige in society. Don't misuse my friendship, Arjuna. I came all the way from Dwarka to help you, and now you're going to leave the battle? And people will criticize you. Yes, his friend Krishna came to support him, but he left even before the battle started. What a coward. Right? It's really, that would be really bad. Arjuna says that, I can tolerate infamy if it will save my life. Because he's in Maya. Arjuna is on the yoga maya. And Krishna says, but this pain will be worse than death, Arjuna. In this verse. Worse than death. So think about it. Bhayat ranaru paratam mams yante tvam maharataha yesham cha tvam bahumato bhutva yasya siladavam. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and thus they will consider you lagavam, insignificant. Purport. Lord Krishna continued to give his verdict to Arjuna. And this is directly from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura's commentary. Do not think that the great generals like Duryodhan, Karna, and other contemporaries will think that you have left the battlefield out of compassion for your brothers and grandfather. No. They will think that you have left out of fear for your own life. And thus, their high estimation of your personality will go to hell. In the Gitamrita, I wrote that, I have considered that the battle will destroy the dynasty. People will think that I'm compassionate. I'll keep my fame, Krishna says. The Maharatis will think you've run away out of fear of your own death. Text 36. Avacha varangscha bahun vadishyanti tavahitaha nindantastavasammartyam tatodhukataram nukim. Your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you? So the term avachavarams means unspeakable words. Right? Avacha or unkind. Avacha. Avacha vacha. unspeakable or unkind words. The acharyas mentioned that the term means like impotent. In other words, a eunuch, a sissy. In English, we say. You have such, you know what the eunuch is, right? Like a man who's like a woman. Right? So that's quite an insult for someone like Arjuna. Hatova prapsyasi svargam jitva va bhokshase mahim tasmat utishta pauntaya yudhaya kritanishtaya. O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavens, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up with determination and fight. So, if the question arises in Arjuna's mind that he might not win the battle, then Krishna speaks this verse, Hatova, even if you die, and you will attain Swarga, Prapsisi Swarga, and Jitva Va, Bhokshase Mahim, if you conquer, then you will enjoy this earthly sphere. Therefore, get up, Utishta Kunteya. So, see, Arjuna was thinking in the beginning that it's a lose-lose situation. That if I fight and win, I'm going to suffer because I won't be able to enjoy anyway. And if I lose, then I'll die and like this. So better if I just go away. But Krishna is proving to him that actually it's a win-win situation. And this is the win-win here. That if, even if you die, you go to Swarga and you enjoy. And if you conquer, if you win, then you'll enjoy your kingdom. So now the last verse of this section. Sukadhuke same kritva labha labho jaya jayo tato yudhaya yujasva naivam papam avapsyasi. Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat. And by so doing, you shall never incur sins. Prabhupada writes, Lord Krishna now directly says that Arjuna should fight for the sake of fighting, because he, Krishna, desires the battle. There is no consideration of happiness or distress, profit or gain, victory or defeat in the activities of Krishna consciousness. So, although this is like the Karmakanda section, because in the beginning of a religious system, when somebody is just beginning, then he's very much concerned that what benefit will I get? So, in order to increase, in order to attract people to performing religious principles, the Vedas offer the Karmakanda level. That if you perform these various religious duties, and if you follow your Swadharma, then you will enjoy riches, longevity, nice children, beautiful wife, and enjoyment in the afterlife in the higher planets. All these pleasures will be yours. Simply follow the religious principles. So that attracts people, because people are interested in their own benefit. It's kind of like a shop owner, a manager of a shop. He puts a sign out on the window of the shop, 50% discount of everything in the store. 50% discount. Then, people see that and they come in the store and they see that they have a few items for 50% discount and the rest of it is, the usual price. So it's kind of like attracting customers for the religion. That, come on, you'll get these nice things if you are religious. If you're a good boy or a good girl, you'll go to heaven. Come on, follow these principles. Right? And if you're a bad boy
oh, you'll go to hell and suffer.
This is the, you know, punishment and reward are the two things given as the motive for someone following karmakanda. Always you will find this, punishment and reward. So you can judge the religious system in such a way. Like if you look at Christianity, it's mainly based on punishment and reward. So it's basically a religious system pitched at the karmakanda level. So you should look for that. You know, punishment and reward. People are interested in this. So in order to facilitate this level, so Krishna's speaking at this. Arjuna, being covered by Yogamaya, mentions he's in concern with enjoyment. And Krishna is addressing this concern of his. But now, in verse 38, he says, Sukha dukhe same kritva. That just forget about happiness and the stress, punishment and reward. Labha labha jaya jayo. That whether you gain or lose, whether you win or lose, you should still perform your duty. Now he's flipped it around completely. The first, from 31 to 37, he was saying that, you know, okay, you want to enjoy it, so you should fight. And if you don't fight, oh, you're really going to suffer. Worse than hell. Worse than death. Because you'll lose your reputation. Right, that's the punishment. And the reward is that you'll go to heaven. And you'll gain a kingdom. But now, in 38, he flips it around. He says, forget all about those things. Forget about punishment and reward. Forget about what you'll win or lose. So you should just fight for the sake of fighting. Basically, for my sake. Right? And what will happen? Naivam papam avapsisi. You'll be free from sin. So Krishna is like giving a hint of the next section, which will be Nishkam Karma or Buddhi Yoga, where if a person acts on this level, disregarding the punishment or reward, then he rises above karmakanda and he comes to the yoga platform. Karma yoga. He begins the yoga. That this is the difference between conventional religion and yoga religion or transcendental religion. We have some marker we can write. First we have the animal level, where people are not concerned about following any religion. You know, this is maybe 99% of of the people nowadays, right? And then you have karmakanda, where punishment and reward are in the motive. And we also recognize that. I mean it's, you know, if you do good on Sankirtan, you get some maha plate, or the life member gives a nice donation, we put his name on a plaque, something like that. It can also utilize something that, you know, when we're connecting people with Krishna, then we may use some of these techniques, right? But Krishna, he does that, right? But if somebody, if he rises above the punishment and reward motive in the mind, then he's not just trying to make himself comfortable in this world or in the next. So that means he has a higher objective. And then it's called yoga. But because he's still, so he may rise up here. He may rise up because now he has a higher objective. mainly it's for purification. And perhaps freedom from reaction. Such a person is, his sights are now geared towards the part of Yom, that which is beyond this mundane universe. He may not have a full or clear understanding of what that is. And he may not be devoted to personal form of God. But he could also be. Right? So, in either case, for self-purification, he performs karma yoga. That means he's... And generally, he will begin from the first level, which is sanishta, or let's see, sakam karma. And then later, he'll rise up to nishkam karma. Nishkam karma yoga or sakam karma yoga? There's two levels. Of course, the person's still selfish, he's still attached to enjoying. So, but then when his objective is raised, he still has a lot of desires. So he can't just, he can't jump up right to the nishkam level. So he comes to the sakam level with desires. And so he gives part of his earnings or the fruits of his work to the higher cause, generally to the Lord. If it's to the Lord, then we add the term Bhagavad Arpita. Bhagavad Arpita Sakam Karma or Bhagavad Arpita Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then, of course, we have Jnana Yoga. Then Ashtanga Yoga. And then on the top, Bhakti Yoga. So in Karma Yoga, you have work and knowledge. Two components. Oh, we have different colors, pens. What is that, red? Okay. Yeah, let me write that in red just so we can... And where's the eraser? Give me the eraser. Okay. And in Jnana Yoga, we have detachment and knowledge. Because one develops knowledge that I'm not the body by performing nishkam karma, when he sacrifices all of the fruits of his work, then he comes to jnana nishta, knowledge that are not the body, but the spirit soul, and that brings detachment. So he has detachment and knowledge. Whereas the person here, he's working, and he has some knowledge, but not as much. Then Ashtanga, there's detachment, knowledge, and meditation. So he has everything that the Jnana Yogi has, but he's also meditating. He's learning to fix all of his mind on the object, or the Supreme Brahman, Parabrahman, in the form of the Paramatma. Okay? And then the Bhakti Yogi has all of these together. Work, detachment, knowledge, meditation, and devotion. So you can see that by analyzing the components of the yoga systems, that Bhakti Yoga contains all of the components of the other systems. So it must therefore be superior. And also it indicates that the other yoga systems are just steps leading one to Bhakti Yoga. So Krishna is already begun his discussion of this whole view. Is called the Yoga Ladder. And Krishna is just finished talking about Karmakanda, and now he's pointing up towards the next level. So below this line we have what is called like conventional religious principles. Most of the religious people in this world, the system, they're like caught in this level only. Whether they're Christians, Muslims, Jews, or even Hindus, many of them are caught in the Karmakanda level. Most of them don't rise much higher than that, unfortunately. So this is kind of like, you know, where the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita meet. You could say, or any Western, you know, religious shastra. So we're going to see now Krishna describing what it's like to, these are all transcendental religious systems, and this is a conventional or mundane religious system.
Somebody is performing some type of activity, but like for like social service. So can this come under this karma?
Wait, you have to say it again because your accent is a little bit indistinguishable for me. I cannot hear.
Somebody is performing activity.
Yes.
And not attached to the result.
Yes.
It is not connected to the Lord.
Okay, it's ordinary karma yoga. We'll get into, we're going to have a lot of time to discuss the details of all these things, because it will continue throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita for the next 5 weeks, every day, practically, you know. But somebody is doing mundane welfare work, and he's giving up the results of his work. It's a karma yoga. It could be nishkam or sakam according to how detached the person is. But Krishna's definition and his indication of what karma yoga should be is yagyartar karmano yatra lokayam karma bandana tadartam karma kuntaya. Like for the sake of God, one should perform one's karma. Not just, you know, for manusha. You know, manusha seva, you know, Bhagavad seva nahi hai. It's different, huh? Madhavs. Yeah, it's not the same. There's a big difference.
Is there a definition for all these bhakti yoga? Bhakti yoga, we know, but karma yoga, as you just said, Jnana Yoga and Ashtanga Yoga, is there a definition?
Yes, we'll get to them. We'll get to them. There's not too much about Jnana Yoga. We don't see, you know, a Jnana Yoga section, but in the last part of the Bhagavad Gita, there are the most detail that we see about Jnana Yoga. The verse Apuryamana Machalam Pratishtam is about Jnana Yoga. But the most detail we see is in chapter 18. Then it's enunciated more definitively, more detailed. Krishna doesn't spend much time describing Jnana Yoga because he doesn't want people to perform it. He wants people to do Bhakti Yoga. And, you know, accordingly, if people are not like ready to sacrifice for the Lord, then okay, they may do that, and there's some purification. But the direct, you know, the direction and the push is toward towards sacrificing for the Lord directly. So, in chapter 12, we also will discuss this in detail. Now, he's just introducing it, so let us also just hear the basic things, and then later we'll get into more detail. When the time comes, we'll discuss. All right, good. So that's the end of that section.